This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Since the 1980s, customs officials at JFK Airport and elsewhere have been encountering incoming passengers whose stomachs are bulging with dozens of latex packets containing heroin or cocaine. The smugglers, who've come to be called mules, are often recruited in Colombia. They can make thousands of dollars in a single trip, enough to transform the life of someone living in poverty. My guest Joshua Marston's new film, Maria Full of Grace, tells the story of a 17-year-old Colombian girl who decides to become a drug mule, swallows her pellets, and flies to America, where things go very wrong. When she gets into trouble, Maria finds her way to a travel agent in Queens named Don Fernando, a large man whom many in the immigrant community rely on for advice and help in times of trouble. Don Fernando is played in the movie by the man who inspired his character, Orlando Tobón. In real life, Tobón has recovered the bodies of hundreds of drug mules who've died in their journeys, and he's returned them to their families in Colombia. We'll speak with Tobón about his work later in our conversation. Maria Full of Grace is Marston's first feature film, and it won the Dramatic Audience Award at this year's Sundance Festival. It's now opening in theaters across the country. Well, Joshua Marston and Orlando Tobón, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Josh, what got you interested in drug mules?
Well, what got me interested was actually hearing the story of someone who had traveled as a drug mule. Someone, a young Colombian woman who I met more or less by chance in Queens, in New York. And in the course of having a conversation with this woman about where she was from and how she had gotten to the United States, she began to open up to me and tell me this very dramatic story about having traveled as a drug mule and what it was like to swallow grapes to get her throat in preparation, and then what it was like to swallow dozens of thumb-sized pellets filled with drugs and then get on a plane. And, you know, it was extraordinarily captivating. I think, like most people, I had heard vague stories about that people did this. It was sort of like urban legend, but I had never actually imagined it from the inside of what it must be like to actually do it. And this was at a time when, for years, I had already been interested in the politics of Colombia and had been interested in the politics of the drug war. And so I got the idea to write a film script that would be sort of a different take on the story about the drug trade, rather than telling the story from the top down, from the point of view of a DEA agent or a drug kingpin, to tell the story from the bottom up, from the point of view of the person at the bottom of the totem pole who's living sort of this very mundane day-to-day experience of what it's like to be caught up in the drug trade.
Now, you spoke to several people who had traveled as drug mules as you researched this film. How many of them do it multiple times? I mean, is it one of these situations where if you do it a dozen times, you can expect to get caught, or do people do it for months, years?
I don't think people do it for years, but I got the feeling that most people did it more than once, unless they happen to get caught or have something tragic happen to them on the first time. I think it's common to end up getting sucked into it for a second or a third or fourth time. I didn't talk to anyone who had done it more than, I think, three times in the people that I met. I think it just becomes very, very difficult at that point to continue taking the risk.
What are the risks they take?
Well, we're talking about, just to be clear, about what a drug mule is doing. They're, you know, ingesting these rubber pellets. Each one of them has 10 grams of heroin or cocaine, and they're swallowing anywhere between 20 and 100, depending on the size of their body. And, you know, frequently, so we're talking about a half a kilo to a kilo of drugs. And if one of those pellets breaks or begins to leak, if your stomach acids begin to sort of do their work on the latex covering and the drugs seep into your blood system, you will die, is basically what it amounts to, and how quickly or slowly you die depends on how quickly or slowly the drugs seep into your body. The other huge risk, of course, is that you would get caught either in Colombia or whatever country you're leaving, which is a terror in its own right, or in the United States. And if you're coming into New York, face very strict drug penalties for, you know, the Rockefeller laws in New York are very, very strict. And so this is a huge risk, but the payoff is also huge. The going rate at this point for a drug mule who's carrying about a kilo, which would be a lot, but a kilo is somewhere between $12,000 and $15,000. And this is in a country in Colombia where the average income in a year is $2,000. So that's like 6 or 7 or 8 years' salary that you could earn for taking one plane ride. And that kilo of, if it's heroin, once it arrives in the United States, just to give you the full picture, is worth about $200,000 to $300,000 on the street.
You also spoke to customs officials and watched them interview people. Is that right?
Yeah.
What's that experience like?
That was fascinating just because, you know, it would have been, for me, the goal was to get some more clear understanding of the other side of things. And what you realize, you know, no matter what your politics on the drug war are, what you realize when you spend time in the airport with customs inspectors is that these are men and women who are showing up to work day in, day out, fighting the good fight, trying to interdict drugs at the border. And it's not an easy job. And customs, if they were allowing me to come in and they were transparent with me, part of it was out of an interest in allowing me to see how the job is really done. Because over the past several years, customs has faced a significant number of class action lawsuits for racial profiling. And so the customs department has had an interest, at least with me, they had an interest in saying, we don't profile. We can't profile because if we did profile, we would miss 95% of the people who are coming into the country because drug traffickers are constantly changing their methods and the people that they're choosing. And their argument is that they need to develop sort of a sixth sense to try and intuit when someone is guilty.
To tell us a little bit about what the customs officials do. I mean, how do they find people they're going to interdict? And when they encounter them, what do they do? What do they say?
Well, customs has, in addition to its regular inspectors, they have a roving team that are more specialized that will go to specific flights, you know, flights from Colombia being some of them, and they will stand around the baggage carousel and just sort of watch people as they come in and they wait for their bags, and they'll look to see maybe who looks nervous, who's waiting. They'll look to see if someone lets their bag that they ultimately choose, if they've left it, go around a couple times. You know, there are all these different theories about among drug mules about whether it's better to go first or last or mix in the middle. And so you have this phalanx of about a dozen or 15 customs inspectors. They're all waiting. And so from the point of view of the drug mule, when they finally get their bag and they turn to go, they're sort of running the gauntlet. And the customs inspector will first, pull someone aside and say, are these all your bags and where are you coming from? And then pull them aside and go through the bags. And then if you seem suspicious, they will take you into a small room. It's about 8x8. Sit you down, frisk you down, first of all, possibly strip search you, depending, and go through all of your belongings once again, quiz you once again. And now we're talking, this is a process that may take an hour or 2 hours. And then they may ask to x-ray you. And they have to ask and get your permission. Then you have to sign a permission form. And if you refuse, then they can make the decision to simply detain you. But oftentimes that moment where they ask you, will you agree to be x-rayed, is part of the whole tactic of intimidation. Because always at every step, the goal for the customs inspector is simply to get the person to admit that they've been traveling with drugs, because that's the far easier route to go for everyone involved. If you agree to an x-ray, they then take you to the medical facility, which at JFK Airport in New York is associated directly related to the airport. And it looks like a little medical facility. It's a little hospital, and they will x-ray you. And then if they find a trove of pellets in your stomach, you're then still under suspicion because they haven't actually recovered the drugs. You know, they don't know that those are drugs necessarily. So you're taken to a trailer. You're shackled to a gurney. You're under arrest, under suspicion. And then when the call of nature comes, you're taken to a little cubicle with a toilet, and under the watchful eye of a customs inspector, you do your business, and the fecal matter comes out and goes directly into a chute where high-powered water jets spray it down, and if there are pellets, they're trundled off directly into a waiting evidence bag. And the customs inspector has to witness it all so that they can testify that the drugs came off of your person.
One of the most compelling scenes in the film is when the main character, Maria, has made the decision to transport drugs in her stomach, and we go to a room where we see the process of loading her up. You actually interviewed, as I understand it, when you were researching, someone who had prepared drugs for swallowers. Take us through the process. What is it?
the process basically is that, you know, we've all heard of condoms filled with drugs. What I found in all the conversation I had was, in fact, fingers of surgical gloves. And what they do is they cut off the fingers and they use the fingers to encase the drugs. They first take the drugs and they weigh them out. They get exactly 9 or 10 grams on a little digital scale and then put it into this contraption that looks a little bit archaic that is would normally be used to make home vitamins. It takes the powder and it presses it into a very, very compact, very dense form. And then that pellet of pure drugs is put into the latex finger, and that latex finger is tied off with dental floss. And that is repeated until the drugs are buried about 5 or 6 layers deep in order to, you know, protect them from your stomach's acids. And what you end up with is something, as I say, about the size of your thumb, which may then further be sealed in wax. And you're presented with anywhere from 50 to 100 of these, and then swallowing them becomes its own ordeal. And the person is usually practiced by swallowing grapes or pellets with flour in them. And it takes hours because it's painful. Your throat begins to scratch. Your mouth begins to taste of latex. People use, they sort of dull your throat down with an anesthetic spray, maybe. They give you Lomatil or something similar to stop your digestive process. Once you get on the plane, you might be given a tranquilizer just to sort of calm your nerves.
When a person swallows all these drugs and then gets on an airplane and makes it into the United States, once they've cleared customs, they meet up with obviously someone arranged in the United States end of the transaction. How are the drugs retrieved?
Well, the person is usually brought to a hotel and they then spend a day or a couple days excreting the pellets, usually done in a bathtub, because if you sit on a toilet, you risk the involuntary habit of reaching to flush, which would be tragic. And the pellets are cleaned off and, you know, smeared with toothpaste to make them smell a little bit more tolerable. And then they're delivered. They're handed over to the person who then will eventually, you know, cut them open and take the drugs out, and then they'll be... That kilo of heroin will then be taken to a mill where it'll be cut with some other substance to sort of mix it down and make it go further and sell it on the streets.
It's interesting to me that Maria, who is the central character here, I mean, who makes this difficult decision to transport drugs in her stomach, is not someone who is in desperate poverty. I mean, she has a job, she has a family, she's not at the very edge of existence. And I'm kind of wondering how you chose to craft her character and what kind of motivations drove her.
It was a very difficult line to walk because there's no question that the people that I spoke to who had done this were in economically dire situations. But at the same time, I realized that it wasn't enough just to say, you know, because someone's economically desperate, they end up becoming a drug mule, because, you know, there are 40% of Colombians, more or less, of what I've read, are living on $2 a day or less. There are a lot of poor people in Colombia, and they are not all drug mules. It's not enough to simply say that because someone's poor, they end up becoming a drug mule. And you have to look beyond the economic and realize that the motivations are as varied as the number of people that are out there. And so it really became sort of a question at a personality level of what it is, who is Maria's character, and what is it that causes her to want to take this risk. I knew that also if I painted her simply as being so economically desperate that she did end up doing this, I would end up with a movie of the week about a young woman who was so desperate she had to swallow drugs and the violins would come out. And that just wasn't the movie I wanted to make. And I began to develop this character of this young woman who is sort of not only economically desperate, but spiritually desperate, that she wants to get out. She's a 17-year-old girl who is, you know, working in a very difficult job that she hates, in a family situation that is stifling her, with a boyfriend that, you know, she's not in love with, and she just wants out. She wants something else. She wants some other opportunity. And that, combined with her economic situation and the fact that she's a little bit naive and a little bit hard-headed and a little bit rebellious, all contrived to put her in the situation where she ends up agreeing to swallow drugs.
Joshua Marston. He directed the new film Maria Full of Grace. We'll hear from Orlando Tobon, who appears in the film after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview about the film Maria Full of Grace, which tells the story of a young Colombian woman who becomes a drug mule smuggling narcotics in her stomach. I spoke with Orlando Tobon, who appears in the film as himself. Orlando Tobon, you are depicted in this film working in a travel agency, a little place where you are at a desk, and you have helped a lot of families who lost people who died carrying drugs, and you've sent a lot of bodies back to Colombia, more than 400. How did you get involved in this activity?
That's a long time ago. We have a lady live next to my apartment, and the sister died in a car accident, and she coming to ask me to help. And then we went to the mortgage in Jamaica, in Queens, and then we find another three bodies living in a mortgage, and the lady told me as soon as we finished to make all the papers for the lady died in a car accident, and she told us, this lady is very lucky because they has family to claim for the body. And this another three guys over there died with drugs in the stomach and nobody claimed the bodies. And, you know, in 15, 20 years, I sent a lot of people back to Colombia. Bodies or ashes of the people, because sometimes we find people in the morgue for 1-2 months dead, and then we cannot send the body. We send the ashes. We cremate the people, and then we send the bodies to the families in Colombia.
There are so many stories that of course, you've encountered in doing this work. Take one of them. Tell us what happens. How do they find you? How do you find the family in Colombia? What do you go through in dealing with this kind of tragedy?
Sometimes the police call me, or sometimes the police find the families in Colombia and tell the families to call me to help them, because most of these people don't have no money at all, and I had to find the money to pay the funerals, and I had to collect the money in the street in Roosevelt Avenue, and I asked my customer. I went down to the bars or discotheques in Queens, and it's very hard, but that we do it. We work to the families and sometimes to the police, because they call me. They know these people is victims of these situations.
Since you're off so often involved in these, I wonder if the police suspect that you know the drug dealers, and do they want to tap your phone or question you about that?
Yes. The police make an investigation. I think the FBI make an investigation. But the thing is, at the end of the investigation, a sergeant coming to my place one day, he say, Orlando, I'm coming to thank you because you do a very nice work. And we finished the investigation yesterday, and thank you because you do a very good job. And I remember, and that day I start to make a collection to another mute, and he gave me $60 to start the collection.
How do most of the drug mules whose bodies that you care for, how do most of them die?
They die in, I think, in the hotel, so when I ride to the hotel.
Do they die from the...
For the overdoses, because one of the condoms exploded, and then the people die like overdoses.
You know, people who haven't seen the film and don't know you will not be aware, but it's a fairly compelling scene when a couple of these people who are drug couriers come into your office. It's a small office. I don't know if this is actually your office in the Queens, but you're a large man, kind of seated at a desk, on the phone a lot, and you have this knowing, reassuring way with these people. Have you developed a way of dealing with people? Why do you think so many people come to you for help?
We have a lot of problems. My community is very large. We live like almost 1 million Colombians live in the area. And we don't have a political representation. And somebody had to do the job. Somebody had to help these people. And thank God I can have a little power to do it. And the people is coming not only to help people with drugs, but they're coming to try to find jobs.
Right.
Sometimes to find an apartment to rent. And I try to help them in different ways.
Orlando, have you heard reaction from Colombians about
this
film?
Yes. This film changed a lot of people. In a few weeks after the film running in Colombia, I remember a little guy called me and said, Orlando, I called from Bogota, from Colombia, and I wanted to thank you. He said, wait, thank you for what? He said, because I intend to go to New York with drugs in my stomach. And when I see this movie, I change my mind. And I see, you know, I talk to my family, I told everybody, and I'm very happy to see this movie because I changed everything in my life. And then this movie saved one life. For me, it's enough.
Well, Joshua Marston, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Orlando Tobón, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting us.
Orlando Tobón appears in the new film Maria Full of Grace. Joshua Marston directed the film. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.